Currently, more than 1 billion people around the world define themselves as agnostic, atheistic, or non-religious, including 15% of Americans. Perhaps more striking, non-religious is not only the fastest growing religious preference in the U.S., but it's also the only one to increase its percentage in every state over the past generation. So today I'm going to talk with two guests, Phil Goldberg and Greg Epstein. And they both have provocative perspectives on who these people are, what they believe, and how they arrived at their worldviews and their moral codes. So first, let me introduce you to what Phil Goldberg will talk about. In February 1968, the Beatles went to India for an extended stay with their new guru, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. It may have been the most momentous spiritual retreat since Jesus spent those 40 days in the wilderness. And those are the words with which Phil Goldberg begins American Veda, his look at India's impact on Western culture. From Emerson, Thoreau, Walt Whitman, succeeding generations absorbed India's science of consciousness. And there were charismatic teachers like Swami Vivekananda and Paramahansa Yogananda. And they then were joined by leading intellectuals, artists, and scientists, Aldous Huxley, Joseph Campbell, Allen Ginsberg, J.D. Salinger, John Coltrane, Dean Ornish, Richard Alpert, Ram Dass, to adapt and disseminate what they learned. And American Veda shows how we have come to accept and live by the central teaching of Vedic wisdom, which is truth is one, the wise call it by many names. My second guest, Greg Epstein, let me tell you about him. Recent best-selling books from a spate of new atheists, including Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, and Sam Harris, have made good arguments, but they stress the irrationality of belief and what's wrong with religion while offering few positive alternatives. In Good Without God, Greg Epstein delivers a response, explaining how humanists, as he terms them, strive to live well, build community, uphold ethical values, and live fully human lives, lifting the human spirit, all without a God. So, I'm going to read one quote here from Epstein. A humanistic approach to life can provide non-religious people with a profound and sustained sense that though there is no single overarching purpose given to us from on high, we can and must live for a purpose well beyond ourselves. But it's not enough to just discover the meaning of life. Humanism is concerned with one of the most important ethical questions, what we do once we found a purpose in life. So I'm going to start the show with Phil Goldberg and then have Greg Epstein join the conversation, and we'll deal with both of these sort of explorations of what's going on with those who are not at church right now. Phil Goldberg, who spent a good portion of the 1970s teaching transcendental meditation and working for the TM organization, is an interfaith minister. He's the director of outreach for spiritualcitizens.net. He blogs regularly on the Huffington Post. He's the author or co-author of 19 books, including Road Signs on the Spiritual Path, The Intuitive Edge, and his newest, American Veda. Welcome, Phil Goldberg.
It is an honor to be with you.
Thank you. Now, as you know, because I know you're actually a listener, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work. And here I think this time the first question really fits perfectly in terms of the influence of Indian spiritual teachings on American culture, because we can start with one individual American, you. So what was your path?
In the 1960s, 60s capital S, I was a college student, and I was a political activist on the front lines. I was a Marxist. I was an atheist. I thought religion was the opium of the people, and I was majoring in psychology. And after a while, got pretty much disillusioned with all those pursuits and all those ways of looking at the world, because they were not providing either answers to the big questions I wanted answered, or a means for me to get my life together. And that sort of twin preoccupation led somehow to reading books about Eastern philosophy and mysticism, yoga and Hinduism and the Buddhist texts, and not only directly, but there was something in the zeitgeist, as you know, because you lived it too, that somehow brought the East to the forefront. It was Ravi Shankar's music. It was the Beatles. It was drugs. It was all sorts, and just the sheer availability and the passion to get answers. And somehow books came into my presence, not only the texts like the Bhagavad Gita and those books, but books by Western interpreters like Alan Watson, Aldous Huxley, and Houston Smith, all these people who presented these ancient teachings in a very rational and sensible way that made sense. I remember reading something and saying, why do they call this mysticism? It's nothing mysterious. It makes good sense. This is a sort of empirical approach to human development and a way of looking at our place in the cosmos. And that got me hooked, and I just wanted more and more, and eventually I picked up meditative practices, and they were transformative. They changed my life for the better.
I'm not going to ask you to do this, which is to fill in the somehows. Twice you said, you know, somehow the ideas came to me. Somehow the books came into my possession. But as I was preparing for this show and reading your book, I remembered some of my own, and I can tell you, too. A roommate of a friend of mine who'd been a friend of mine in high school and went to another college than I did, I visited him, and he was reading Nature, Man, and Woman. Now, not Indian, but that's Alan Watts.
Alan Watts, sure.
And he kind of read me a couple of quotes. I bought it, and that was the first for me.
Right.
Meditation. I was going through a rough patch in my marriage. I can remember sitting on the beach, and I happened to bring a paperback book with me by Herbert Benson, which was the relaxation response. Again, a very Western interpretation of
derived
meditation.
Derived directly from the scientific research on TM back in 1970. I was one of Benson's subjects when he did his first study, just because I was hanging out at the Cambridge TM Center, and there I was.
Very good. I'm speaking with Phil Goldberg, and we're talking about his book, American Veda, From Emerson and the Beatles to Yoga and Meditation, How Indian Spirituality Changed the West. And you can learn more at Philip Goldberg, philipgoldbergoneword.com, or at americanveda.com, and Veda is V-E-D-A. And that website, which I know is quite ambitious, is in its early stages.
Very early, yes.
So you can visit, but at this point it's a Potemkin village. There is nothing behind most of the things. And a little later we're going to be joined by Greg Epstein. He's the humanist chaplain at Harvard University, which is something you probably didn't know existed. Neither did I. And the author of Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. Why did you write this book?
I actually wanted to write this book in the 1980s because my own experience, which I gave you the beginning of, led me to see that the principles that were coming here from India, mainly the philosophy of Vedanta, and the practices of yoga, including meditation, all the others, were transforming people's lives. I saw that in myself. I saw it in thousands of others through the 70s. And then I saw it seeping in to other areas of the culture in subtle ways. It started to affect psychology. It started to affect healthcare. It started to affect scientists who were studying consciousness. It started to even affect physicists. It was affecting the arts. And I saw it seeping in and people being affected by these teachings without even knowing they were because of the sort of transmission taking on different forms through various Western experts.
Yeah, I mean, as I was preparing, I was thinking of the word absorbed.
Yeah.
You know, they've become absorbed so that now it's like fish in water. You don't even know that where that came from. It's just something you think, something you say. You talk about karma and you don't
exactly
think at all
right
where it comes from.
And so I saw that happening. I proposed that I thought this was a major phenomenon. I proposed the book, couldn't find a publisher. 20 years later, the time had come, and the religion editor at Doubleday Books had the same idea I did at the same time, and a nice confluence of circumstances entered in. But that's the publishing story.
Right,
the personal story is, I think this is a much more important phenomenon than people realize. That, it is a bigger phenomenon than people realize. More people are affected by what we've imported and absorbed from India than is generally recognized. The spiritual but not religious theme of yours being one a manifestation of that. The other is that it is affecting how people see the world and behave in the world in a way that I think is potentially transformative to the culture.
Positive.
In a positive way.
So in other words, you both want to often actually, I mean, not, you know, 5 out of 6 books, but often the authors say, I realize what I was looking at was something that had tangible existence, but people didn't know it yet. I remember when I did Paul Ray on the cultural creatives. Uh-huh. He said they don't know that there's 45 million of them right. around the world and this sort of thing. So that's part of it, is to name it and thus – but also to promote it. Yes?
Yes. I have a point of view, and the point of view is this way of looking at spirituality that we've absorbed and adapted from India is not only a needed antidote to the foolish kind of polarization of atheists on the one side, religious literalists, biblical literalists on the other, but a way of being spiritual in the world that is rational and reasonable and sensible and matches the kind of pluralistic, globalized world we live in a way that would make things much more ecumenical, so to speak.
Well, one quote that really struck me in the book is, and at this moment I'm forgetting whether it was Toynbee or Durant.
Probably Toynbee.
1953, he says something like, do you have the quote?
Yes.
Go for it.
Oh, okay. Actually, it was 1952.
Oh, okay.
The Catholic, in the small sense of the word, minded Indian religion. I'm sorry, the Catholic-minded Indian religious spirit is the way of salvation for all religions in an age in which we have to learn to live as a single family if we are not to destroy ourselves.
So this is 52. We've come out of World War II. We're living in the age of the bomb.
Exactly.
And he says at that point, long before much was happening, and even most of your story takes place after that.
That's right.
There have been stirrings, but any sort of a wave begins later. But he sees it as fitting the needs that we now embody in the 21st century.
And here we are with religious extremism going amok and people needing to believe for whatever pathological reasons that their way is the only way and they're going to impose it on others. And here you have this ancient teaching
right.
that, you know, many paths are valid ways of being spiritual in the world, including secular.
Right.
Right. Including scientific.
I'm going to make one other reference, then I'm going to ask you to expand a little bit on what you just said. I remember when I read the book, Reality Isn't What It Used to Be by Walter Truett Anderson. And I remember what he said, and this again was very early in the confrontation between Islam and Western religion and Western society. But he said it's a confrontation between those who can see more than one truth and those who see one truth. Whereas in the past, it used to be my truth against yours. He said the real confrontation now is those, whatever their one truth is, it's their confrontation with modernity, which says there are many. So I just will leave that. What I wanted you to do right now is tell us, you've named one, which is this many paths, pluralism, and so on. What are 2 or 3 of the other key principles that have come through the Vedas, through Indian spirituality, and infuse American society?
Okay, so one is this pluralistic take on spirituality. Along those same lines is an individuated approach to spirituality, so that the individual spiritual seeker, or the secular seeker of self-development, if it's, you know, in that context, should and must carve out his or her own way to do this. Hence the many paths aspect of this is not just choose your religion, it's choose the nuances of your personal spiritual life, the practices, the approaches that serve your individual perspective, your personality, your inclinations, and so forth. This is fundamental Vedantic yogic teaching.
And this is where you get the 4 big paths of yoga.
Right. Karma yoga, bhakti yoga, jnana yoga, and raja yoga, which were outlined as long ago in the Bhagavad Gita.
And as you say, that each of them will be the most appropriate path for a certain kind of person, and they are, what's the English for I mean, bhakti is...
Bhakti is devotional.
Okay.
Karma yoga is the yoga of action, selfless action. Jnana yoga is the yoga of the intellect, of understanding and study. Raja yoga is a kind of psycho-spiritual approach that emphasizes practice, meditation, and so forth. But they overlap significantly.
I'm sure.
So that...
So it isn't merely that there are, rather than one, four, but it's saying these are four big...
Right.
Envelopes, but they're going to
open. And you'll lean in different directions at different times.
But the key lesson is we shouldn't expect that good works would work for everybody, or faith would work for everybody.
Right.
So that's the second one. The other one
is the emphasis on individual inner experience of the sacred or the divine, whatever you want to call it, as opposed to belief systems. So what you believe is less important than what you experience within yourself. And that is the sort of fulcrum of Vedic spiritual teachings. Beliefs are good. They're important. Faith is good and important, but that's an individual thing. What matters is the individual spiritual development, that this is a developmental process. Something psychologists have now picked up on, and so have added, because of Indian philosophy and Indian yogic teachings and Buddhist teachings, perspective that has expanded psychologists' view of what is human development.
So a Maslow with the hierarchy of needs and so on?
And who was affected very strongly by the Indian mystical texts.
Very good. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Phil Goldberg, the author of American Veda. From Emerson and the Beatles to Yoga and Meditation, How Indian Spirituality Changed the West. I read the whole subtitle so you get the handle, because American Veda, who knows what that might mean. And you can learn more at Philip Goldberg, one word, philipgoldberg.com and americanveda.com. A little later, we're going to be joined by Greg Epstein. He's the humanist chaplain at Harvard University, the author of Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe.
Philip with one L.
Very good. Your very brief answer to this one, your book is not about Hinduism per se, is it?
Yeah. Well, that's a complicated question, because the word Hinduism is a very complex thing, and who gets to define it and how it's defined is so forth. But the reason I did not use the word except sparingly in the book is because there's a lot of confusion about what Hinduism is, and because we associate it with the sort of everyday normative practice of religion in India. What came here was the sort of kernel of Vedic teachings, which were formulated by people who understood the West, were compatible with science, had been educated properly and spoke English, and extracted out the essence of Vedic teachings without necessarily the nuances of Indian culture that we associate with Hinduism. And so that's why I use the word sparingly, because if I used it, people will think I'm talking about religion in India.
That's right. And isn't there a word, the symbols and the rituals versus the...
The esoteric as opposed to the exoteric.
Yeah. That's it. Okay. So this is not a book about Hinduism as practiced in India. It's about the essence.
And what came here.
So here's a question. These things that you've pointed out, pluralism, that there are many paths, individuated paths, that it might be different for different people, inner experience being crucial. We set up at the very top that we both, I think, believe that these are helpful in our current times. And they seem to be in distinction to at least the broad sweep of Islam, Christianity, Judaism a little less, but still. What was it about India that allowed this to emerge?
That's a hard question to answer, because it emerged thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. But whatever allowed it to emerge in the consciousness of the ancient sages got preserved. And it was preserved as an oral tradition and then as a written tradition. And there were people smart enough to preserve it in the midst of colonization and all the rest of the craziness that happened to India and all the tragedies that befell India. And then in the 19th century, people who were associated with what was then called the the Hindu Renaissance or the Bengal Renaissance that formulated these ancient teachings into modern form so they could be compatible with a scientific age and with a Western perspective on social progress and so forth.
Okay. So that's interesting, though, that, yeah, we don't know now, what was about. But, I mean, when they made their transition, whatever, this is what emerged as an organized religion versus what.
Whereas in the West, the ancient mystical teachings that emphasized the same kind of things we're talking about somehow got lost and were buried in monasteries and then got to the point where what we think of now as Jewish mysticism or Kabbalah and what we think of as contemplative Christianity and the great Christian mystics were sort of esoteric things that the lay people and even ordinary clergy did not pay any attention to.
And the papal authority.
And the papal authority.
We can go back to the Council of Nicaea and those sorts of things.
That's right.
But we won't in this show. One feeling that I got, and this isn't really a finding, but one feeling that I got as I read the book personally was that you had said, I'm going to focus on the influence of India. I'm going to focus on the influence of Vedic teachings. For me, having gone through this 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, experience pretty contemporaneously with yourself, whether it was Buddhism or Vedic teachings, I never made a distinction.
Right.
I picked up one book, I picked up another, I picked up a practice. And so I was troubled a little bit, like, I know you don't really believe this, but reading the book, it seemed like, you know, that they could be separated or that one was more important. So just answer that.
I mentioned it in the introduction because it's an important point. The Buddhist thread that came to America is just as important as what I focused on in the book, but it would have made the book twice as long and complicated. And histories of Buddhism in America have been written and written very well. This had not been. So I had to focus on the what we would think of as the teachings that came via the Hindu path. But you're absolutely right, because they overlap. And people like you and me, and I would venture to say most of these spiritual but not religious cohort, have drawn from both traditions and others, Sufism, all the others, because we're a pragmatic people who does what works for
them. So once one does believe in the pluralism, then one goes out and bees pluralistic.
Yes, but I want to add one more other thing. In a sense, you know, Buddhism is also a Vedic tradition because it arises from the same India that, you know, Buddha was a reformer in the way Jesus was a reformer of the Hebraic tradition.
Yeah. Right. I did. You nestled it within and said, so even he was influenced.
And they complemented
each
other.
So he's just an early.
And the Zen teachers who came here made people more open to India, and the Indian teachers that came here made people more open to Buddhism and so forth.
Yeah. Religion and science. Speak just a little bit about that, because one point I know you have made about the Vedic traditions, about Indian spirituality, is that it is, in some sense, scientific, empirical.
Yeah, and that's what was emphasized when the teachers came here. They made a very big point. If you look at all the major gurus and swamis and so forth who came here, they said, I am not asking you to convert to Hinduism. This is not – I'm giving you a science of consciousness. Here are essentially precepts, hypotheses. This is the Vedantic yogic view of the world. If you practice these techniques, if you practice meditation, if you put into effect what we're proposing here, you can then verify it for yourself. So it was a way that was compatible with a scientific, rational perspective. And I think that's one of the main reasons it appealed to people. There was also nothing in Vedantic teachings that contradicts evolution or any of the major thrusts of scientific progress in the world. Some of the great Indian teachers were very well versed in Darwin and so forth and incorporated those. Sri Aurobindo, for example.
Let me see. It seems also, I think when your story kicks off in the, let's say, the recent past, It's Vivekananda. It's 1893, visiting America, right? So it seems that the primary time that this influence has been happening is a time when science has also been moving toward relativity and quantum physics, which is a view of reality that is very congruent.
That's exactly right. And Vivekananda was well educated in science. So was Yogananda. And, of course, they affected Emerson and Thoreau and people like that who were, you know, very well versed with in Darwin and found it perfectly compatible. Then come into the 20th century and you had people uncovering quantum mechanics and so on and relativity. And those seemed perfectly compatible to the point where physicists like Schrodinger and Oppenheimer and all those people were essentially drawing metaphysically from Vedantic texts. And then people popularized it, people like Fritz Capra with the Tao of Physics and Carl Sagan talking about, you know, Shiva on cosmos. And
well, you know, and Capra then goes from the Tao of Physics to the turning point in which he's now talking about systems thinking. And systems.
Right.
Well, this, I think, systems thinking is congruent with the science.
Yes.
And with the spirituality.
Because the awareness of interconnection comes with this kind of expansion of consciousness that the teachings afford people. The awareness of interconnection, the awareness of something vast and beyond ourselves, and the flexibility of mind to be able to comprehend the best of science and the best of spirituality and see that they're not incompatible. That's why I think one of the – if people realize that there is more than just religion and just atheism, they end up with this kind of, you know, pluralistic perspective.
Well, I'm going to bring Greg Goldstein into the conversation – Greg Epstein into the conversation. Goldberg Epstein.
I know.
What am I going to do? Greg Epstein, who I'm going to bring in now, holds a B.A. in religion and Chinese as well as an M.A. in Judaic studies from the University of Michigan and an M.A. in theological studies from the Harvard Divinity School. In addition to serving as the humanist chaplain at Harvard University, he's a regular contributor on Faith, an online forum on religion produced by Newsweek and the Washington Post. I wonder if it's still produced by Newsweek now that it's part of the Daily Beast, but we'll find that out. And his work has been featured on NPR and in several national publications. Good Without God is his first book, and you can learn more about his work at Harvard Humanist. One word, harvardhumanist.org. Welcome, Greg Epstein.
Hi, Terrence. And hi, Phil. Thank you
Greg,
for having me as part of this conversation.
Yeah, my thought as I was putting this together was I came across Phil's book first and then yours, and I thought this was a good pairing. And then with what he was just saying prior to that little break when I introduced...
You know, the last line was a good transition where he talked about, you know, there's more than just religion and just atheism, and that's certainly a good transition into talking about my book and even the work that I do.
So what I first wanted you to do, and then we'll go more specifically into... We'll set up your, you know, the work as humanist chaplain, your path and so on, but any responses to the conversation so far, just to keep it fresh?
Well, you know, I'm fascinated by the conversation so far. I grew up with this conversation. I'm age-wise, I'm the next generation.
That's right. I know that.
My father was very much somebody who was reading, you know, and experiencing some of the same sort of transitions that you guys have been talking about. And, you know, I grew up where all the books on the walls of the apartment that I grew up in New York City were, you know, it was covered with Indian mysticism, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, but also, you know, East Asian, African, Christian, Jewish, Muslim mysticism, and the sort of psychological and historical studies of all of that stuff. And I grew up wondering, well, if you've got all this diversity of these, you know, these diverse paths, what's really true?
Mm-hmm.
What is really something that I can hang my hat on? And I struggled with that, you know, in my early studies.
Okay, so let me just jump into then a little bit about, we'll set you up a little bit. Your this role, this title, humanist chaplain at Harvard University. My first question is, what does that mean, and how long has such a position existed?
So I'm a chaplain at Harvard University for humanists, atheists, agnostics, and the non-religious. And, you know, it essentially means that I'm working with a group of people who are not religious in the traditional sense. I'm working with them based on the, you know, something that I call and that many others call humanism, which is, you know, in short, I mean, the title of my book, Good Without God, the idea that there's only this one world. It's the natural world. It's the only world we can ever know. But in that world, we've got an ability and a responsibility to make it count, to make our time in this world count, to make our relationships with other people count, and to leave it better than we found it. And I'm working with that group, and it's a position that's existed for about 35 years now. But it was always a sort of a small thing, and humanism was a very, you know, in my understanding of the history of it, was a very sort of almost silent partner in a lot of the discussions that you guys have been describing over the past generation or two. But it's now becoming much more prominent. It's now becoming much better understood that when you're talking about the spectrum of religious pluralism in the United States and the world, you've got to refer also to the non-religious people, to the people who aren't accepting that the truth would come from any particular religious tradition, but that it has to come from human wisdom. And you know, people are more and more referring to us as humanists. President Obama has been very aware in his life and in his speeches, you know, that yes, you can find the golden rule, you can find truth and ethics in all the religions, or you can find it in humanism. And that's just one example.
Well, he is the son of an atheist and a humanist, right?
That's right.
Yeah, which may or may not be a first, but it's interesting. You talked about the apartment you grew up in, and then you talked about your present work. If you could, a little bit of your path, because obviously in reading your bio,
sure,
that you chose to pursue religion, both undergraduate and the MA in theological studies, mm-hmm, and the MA in Judaic studies. People would not necessarily say this is a guy that calls himself non-religious.
Yeah, I like to quote a novel that I like and say that I have a very religious personality without a scintilla of religious belief. And I grew up around it. Like I said, I grew up in New York City in an extremely diverse neighborhood religiously. There were people in my neighborhood, you know, being white was a minority, not to mention I had secular Jewish parents. But, you know, there were people from every religion, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, I could go on. And there was no majority. And so, again, there was a sense of, I saw all these people that I was friends with, and they would go to different religious holiday celebrations and wear different costumes and eat different religious foods and what have you. And there was a sense that we were all good enough people. Nobody seemed to have access to the truth, capital T, you know, but that there's had to be something that was true was an idea that I got. I mean, we couldn't just be all relativism of, well, what you say and what your family and what your family's texts say is true and what mine say is true and what yours, you know, that sort of distorts the notion of the word truth. So I pursued these things. I wasn't particularly interested in Judaism that I'd grown up around, you know, with my family, because, you know, I went to synagogues and I had a bar mitzvah and people were not, they didn't seem really truly devoted to the words that they were praying. And I found that in the churches that I would visit but I wasn't going to become a Muslim, but I was compelled by the East. I mean, I picked this up from my father and his generation, this idea that if you go to the East, you'll find the truth. You'll find something special and inspirational and unique. And so, you know, I sat and studied, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours of Chinese in order to, you know, to study some of the meditation Buddhism texts in the original. And I went to China and Taiwan to try to look at those. And, you know, when I got there, I found that there were people there that were, you know, they were studying this stuff that were just as lukewarm about Buddhism and Taoism and Zen as the Reformed Jews that I grew up around in New York.
That's true.
And so that's pretty much how I discovered humanism. It was the idea that, well, people created religion, not vice versa. That people are people, and that no one religious tradition has access to the truth. It's all what we invented, and we came up with some very good inventions, and we came up with some really lousy inventions, spiritually speaking.
And I would say, and we came up with some inventions in a time when they were the likely invention, and,
yes,
and that unlike our communications devices or our transportation devices, we hold to them thousands, yes, of years later.
That's right. I mean, that's the nature of religion, is that it's naturally conservative, right? That people don't like to admit, once they've sort of attached the names of their ancestors and their deities to a spiritual insight like do unto others as you'd have done to you, they don't like to admit, oh, by the way, 75% of what we also wrote in that book, we got completely wrong.
Right, right.
Hard because, we would do well to preserve the best insights of all these ancient traditions. And build on them, but it's very hard to do that without, sort of consciously, without still be able to consciously admit, yes, but here's what we got wrong, and here's what we got wrong, and here's how we evolved the process.
Right. That's the key thing, is it doesn't even have to be, here's what we got wrong. Here's what we saw then.
Right.
We don't necessarily do that about other things as they evolve. We don't go, weren't we stupid to, use oxen? No. Perfectly
right.
Smart thing to do. Philip, if you have anything to say to Greg based on what you've heard.
I find it fascinating that there's a humanist a chaplain at Harvard, and I think it's a perfectly wonderful thing because the sort of secular, what we think of as secular humanism is a important perspective to add to this mix. It would not be, to me, incompatible with anything we've been talking about the Indian influence on the West, because the notion that there are many paths to higher consciousness or to great ethical behavior or to the experience of the sacred would necessarily include a scientific or humanistic approach. I would bet that if Greg were to meet, and maybe has, Swami Tyagananda, who's the Hindu chaplain at Harvard, they would have a perfectly wonderful conversation, because they would not be incompatible vis-a-vis the modern world and science and so on and so forth.
Greg?
Swami Tyagananda and I are friends.
I figured.
And I've very much enjoyed my interaction with him. And I do want to say a word about India and humanism. I talk in my book about the fact that humanists, the non-religious, people who are good without God, trace their history back thousands of years. That humanism is a tradition throughout human history that goes back. Some people trace it back to the ancient Greece and ancient Rome and that sort of thing, and that's absolutely true. But it also goes back directly to ancient India.
I wouldn't doubt it.
And that the philosopher economist Amartya Sen, who's also a professor here at Harvard, says that that ancient Sanskrit has more atheist and agnostic literature in it than any other ancient language. And in fact, we just had a speaker here at Harvard, a guy named Lavanam, whose father was named Gora. They both have one name because they removed their second name, which in Indian traditions is a caste-based name.
Mm.
They're leaders of the Indian atheist and humanist community, which is very prominent and very positive. And they worked very, very prominently in Gandhi's day with Gandhi, who had great respect for the sort of community of atheists and humanists in India, and the fact that it often did social work with working with the untouchables and working with widows who are victimized in many aspects of Hinduism, just as forcefully as some of the work that Gandhi himself did. So,
well, I can imagine, Greg, I'm cutting in, but I can imagine that if you don't have a religious tradition, even one as pluralistic as one we said, it may be easier to also not buy into a caste tradition. In other words,
or any of the sort of shadow side of religion that has evolved in all the great traditions. And it's very difficult to separate out the historical and cultural elements from the religious, especially in a sort of a small village-based culture where they all intertwine. But I understand Greg's perspective. I was raised by atheists. I had a lot less religion in my life than he did. And my mother was the most ethical and moral person I've ever known, and she was, you know, a straight-on atheist.
Yeah.
So, you know, religion does not have a monopoly on these things.
Which is his book, you know, really the goal of your book. If I were to ask you why you wrote your book, your answer would be?
Well, it's by the way, it's not a book to say, oh, you know, yes, you can be good without God.
Right.
Because, you know, if one is asking oneself, can one be good without God in this day and age where there are a billion non-religious people out there, that's not just a question, that's a prejudice.
Exactly. Very
so
good.
It's first of all to dispel that prejudice, but second of all to really explore what does it mean to be good, you know, in a world where a billion of us have given up a belief in God. And what does it mean to be a humanist, to be part of a positive tradition that says we're going to make this world better, we're going to make our lives and our relationships better, you know, not because a God tells us to or because a religious text tells us to, but because we human beings recognize that's good for everyone and that's what makes our lives meaningful.
Yeah. Let me ask you one thing, because you use the term humanist. You approach this with the term humanist. For me, this may sound silly, but that sounds a bit species chauvinistic. Okay, you
no,
with
no,
me?
Because one of
the key understandings of a certain spiritual and not religious worldview is the realization that we're not separate from the rest of nature, that appropriate moral and ethical arise from this realization that we're one in a system of dynamic, interdependent systems and so on. So,
yes. So first of all, you know, it's a good question. I talk about this question of is humanism speciesist in the book, and I do say no, but you know, it's fair enough to wonder about that. But a couple things. First of all, if somebody, you know, identifies with the ideas that I'm talking about, considers themselves in some way good without God, that, you know, but or non-religious or whatever, but you like a different term, whether it's atheist, agnostic, free thinker,
secular,
please go in peace, secular. I mean, it's not a big deal. The terminology is really secondary. I just, you know, I mean, it's like the GLBT movement or the LGBT movement or the gay or the queer or whatever, right? I mean, you know, let's forget about the acronym and worry about the message.
Yeah.
And so I like the word humanist, though, not because it's saying, oh, human beings are the kings and queens. No, of course not. I like that word for a couple reasons. Number one, because it emphasizes the human in the sense that we're only human, that there is no such thing as perfection that we can hope for or that we have to feel pressured to attain, that we're only human, we're all flawed, we all make mistakes, and we're trying to help one another. I like the word humanist because it emphasizes, you know, that we're trying to do good on behalf of all human beings and on behalf of the entire natural world that surrounds us and sustains us, and that includes all sentient life and, you know, that we have discovered and that we may discover. And then finally, I like the word humanist because I don't want to just define myself as an atheist or agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
I define myself according to a God that somebody else might happen to believe in, because that's not my belief, that's their belief. So I want to define myself positively according to what I actually believe and stand for, not just somebody else's term. Humanist is a positive term, not just the negative non-religious term.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems to me, that perhaps how old is the term?
The word humanist, well, it goes back, it's had different meanings. Just like the word Hinduism, the word Hinduism and the word humanism, I like to say, are similar in the sense that they refer to about a billion people. But not all those billion people, each of those, you know, in each of those cases, not all those billion people, you know, identify themselves with that word. The word wasn't given to those people, you know, by themselves. You know, in Hinduism, it was actually imposed by the British, and, you know, in humanism, you know, it's a word that some people have chosen, you know, and it refers to a diverse group of people. And so, you know, the word goes back to the Renaissance, you know, where there were some Christians who said, not all truth is theological truth. There's truth for human sake as well. And that those people called themselves humanists. And then it was adopted in about, you know, the last 100 or so years to refer to this positive way of living life and of looking at life, for non-religious people.
Okay. So it's a term that you walked into, and when you looked around and said, what else could I call it? There wasn't anything better, really. And the thing one thing that I read in your writing that is sort of here we are. I mean, I'm inferring from what you said, but here we are, we humans. It struck me that it had a sense of humility about it. Do you know what I mean? That it's like, what's the best we can do with this human life we've been given? And that was, as much as anything, why it fit.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. That we really are. It's not easy to live a good life, whether with God, you know, with a belief in God or without one. And we struggle. And what I'm looking for is something that admits that. Something that doesn't try to say, oh, well, if you just follow my teaching or his teaching or her teaching, you'll live the perfect enlightened life, because that's, you know, those things tend to be illusions. It admits that we are struggling and we want to struggle together, and that we really can make a lot of progress if we are willing to help one another.
Okay, let me ask. I'm going to ask you one more question, Greg, which you can chime in on, Phil, and then I want to read you both a couple of quotes from other folks with the last 8 or 9 minutes we've got, and have you respond to them so that people get another flavor here. But I mentioned the notion of being good without God to my 16-year-old stepson, and he pointed out that he thinks a lot of what draws people to organized religion is the need for community. Mm-hmm. And he said, wouldn't it be nice if such opportunities for a community existed on a regular basis, you know, a Sabbath kind of thing, for those who didn't have religion? Greg?
Well, I think he needs to come to the Boston area for college then.
It's on his list, believe me.
I talk a lot in my book about the fact that both, not only am I working on this in my work at Harvard and in the Boston area, but that there are communities working on this idea exactly of creating a community for, you know, a positive, supportive community for non-religious people. And it's going on around the country and actually around the world. And it's become very strong in certain places. I just visited the Humanist Society of Scotland, and I found out that in Scotland today, this year, in 2010, the most marriages in Scotland are going to be performed by the Church of Scotland, the second most by the state registry, sort of like the Justices of the Peace, the third most by the Humanist Society of Scotland, and the fourth most by the Catholic Church. So, you know, in Scotland, it's just one country among many where this positive non-religious community is becoming extremely influential. And we're doing weddings, and we're doing funeral ceremonies, you know, and we're doing baby naming ceremonies, and we're celebrating holidays, and we're doing meditation. I have a section in my book about Herbert Benson and the relaxation response and humanist meditation, which we do all the time in our community, and music and all these things, you know, that you can do without a belief in a God, without a belief in the supernatural or the magical or even the mystical.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Greg. And I think that, I mean, in addition to a book that, you know, that says what your book says, that movement is the edge of the future that excites me.
I'm
interested in this. I mean, I hope that they can follow both the work that I'm doing at Harvard and others, you know, who are doing like work. You know, they can find me on Facebook or join my email list or whatever it is.
I'm very pleased to hear this, because one of my interests has been this spiritual but not religious cohort that has been so, I think, made possible because of the teachings of the East that came here and gave him a framework to do that. But one of the things that was missing there is community. So if there are efforts to provide the kind of community that organized religions did for people who are more comfortable. But the one thing I would add is a note of caution about the one element that we associate with religion that is not necessarily present in secular teachings, although it's creeping in to psychology, transpersonal psychology, to what Greg just said, is the element of transcendence. That element of individuals having access to practices that expand consciousness beyond the limitations of the individual self, so that there's an experience of connectedness to a larger whole, whether you call that in religious terms or scientific terms, is a critically important aspect of human growth and development.
Greg?
Yeah, well, if what you're talking about there is something like a meditation technique or a way of becoming more aware of oneself to, in order to have more compassion for others, I mean, humanists basically say whatever there's reasonable amounts of scientific evidence to show is going to work, is going to help us to cultivate compassion and mindfulness, let's do it. And you know, we don't rely on a dogmatic teaching of how it should work, but we are very actively engaging in all those things. And in my community especially, we've got a regular group that does meditative contemplative practices from all the world's religions in a way that's compatible with scientific research.
Well,
and more humanist groups around the country are adopting this idea.
That's good to hear.
And Greg, what I was hearing and what he was saying was not so much even the practice that gets you there, but the aspiration toward transcendence, yeah. Which to me is, and so I want to shift now and I'm going to read some words from Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins, best known as one of the world's great atheists and one of the world's great evolutionary biologists. But this is from an interview I did with Dawkins. Dawkins says, "Unweaving the Rainbow, which I wrote in the late 90s, was my answer to those people who say that science, and in particular my worldview and the selfish gene, was cold and bleak and loveless. Maybe I could read a few words from the opening of Unweaving the Rainbow, which I've set aside and asked to be read at my funeral." So Richard Dawkins, these are the words that he wants. Quote, "We are going to die, and that makes us the lucky ones. Most people are never going to die because they're never going to be born. The potential people who could have been here in my place, but who will in fact never see the light of day, outnumber the sand grains of Sahara. In the face of these stupefying odds, it is you and I, in our ordinariness, that are here. Here's another respect in which we are lucky. The universe is older than 100 million centuries. Within a comparable time, the sun will swell to a red giant and engulf the earth. Every century of hundreds of millions has been in its time, or will be when its time comes, the present century. The present moves from the past to the future like a tiny spotlight inching its way along a gigantic ruler of time. Everything behind the spotlight is in darkness, the darkness of the dead past. Everything ahead of the spotlight is in the darkness of the unknown future. The odds of your century being the one in the spotlight are the same as the odds that a penny tossed down at random will land on a particular ant crawling somewhere on the road from New York to San Francisco. You are lucky to be alive, and so am I. We are lucky to be alive, and therefore we should value life. Life is precious. We're never going to get another one. This is it. Don't waste it. Open your eyes. Open your ears. Treasure the experiences that you have, and don't waste your time fussing about a non-existent future life after you're dead. Try to do as much good as you can now to others. Try to live life as richly as possible during the time that you have left available to you." And most people do not know, I would think, that that's the way Richard Dawkins sees things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's the beautiful side of Richard Dawkins, just as you said, Terrence, that I probably agree with him on more than I disagree with him on. I've been somewhat, I've had some disagreements with Richard in terms of what non-religious people like he and I should do in terms of critiquing religious people. He's a little bit more inclined to go out and make fun, and
yeah.
This is his words, make fun of religion than I am, because I think that there's, we got to acknowledge that there is that cultural inheritance that goes along with religion, and when you make fun of it, you're making fun of, people's stories and memories and families and that sort of thing. But certainly the message that you just gave from him, I mean, this message of the more we understand about science and understand about ourselves, the more inspired we truly are, I really agree with.
He's evoking in there a kind of sense of wonder and awe that is the core of the religious impulse that Einstein also addressed. And so you can approach the sacred and the divine, so to speak, through secular scientific ways. It's a shame that in his public pronouncements, he only makes fun of the worst of religion and does not recognize that.
Yeah, anyone, by the way, who is interested in that, if you go to my pod, my website, terrencemcnally.net, the entire podcast of my interview with Richard Dawkins is there, and it's an interview that leads to that as the conclusion. So it's a way of seeing him. I'm going to read just one other thing, and we're really wrapping up, but I want people to also. The work of Stuart Kaufman in Reinventing the Sacred. Are both of you aware of that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm just going to read a little bit. What we think of as natural law may not suffice to explain nature. Partially beyond law, we are in a co-constructing, ceaselessly creative universe whose detailed unfolding cannot be predicted. Therefore, we truly cannot know all that will happen. In that case, reason, the highest virtue of our beloved enlightenment, is an insufficient guide to living our lives. We must reunite reason with our entire humanity. And in the face of what can only be called mystery, we need a means to orient our lives. How much faster are our lives understood as part of the unfolding of the entire universe? We are invited to awe, gratitude, and stewardship. This planet and this life are God's work, not ours. If God is the creativity in the universe, we are not made in God's image. We too are God. We can now choose to assume responsibility for ourselves and our world to the best of our limited wisdom, together with our most powerful symbol, God, as the creativity in the natural universe. So he basically says we are part of the creativity, and that is his name for God.
That's a very Vedantic point of view, by the way.
Exactly. Greg, last point.
You know, look, I'm all for the idea that we need to look for sources of inspiration beyond just our reason. I mean, human life is about so much more than reason. We are powerfully, profoundly emotional beings, and we need to connect with one another perhaps more than we need anything else. That being said, you know, Stewart's idea that God is mystery and creativity. I already have a belief about God. God is, to me, the most influential literary character that human beings have ever created.
And
you find God in the Bible.
I've got to let it go. I got to let it go with that. I've been speaking with Greg Epstein, humanist chaplain at Harvard University, author of Good Without God. You can learn more at harvardhumanist.org. Also with Phil Goldberg, author of American Veda. You can learn more at philipgoldberg.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at my website, terrencemcnally.net, or worldthatjustmightwork.com. You can sign up there or at iTunes to have it delivered to you weekly. You can sign up there or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, for a weekly announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and a little background on the issues. Thank you to Philip Goldberg and Greg Epstein. Keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence.